You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and pleased to be back in my chair here. After a bit of bouncing around, unanticipated bouncing around for a couple of days. In any case, I'm here, and in the second hour of our program, maybe even in the first, I don't know, but particularly in the second hour, I want to get into this whole thing about the Miranda rights, and well, we'll get to that with this this terrorist or this kid or whatever he is. Les Leopold will be with us in our third hour. How to make $1 million an hour? Why hedge funds get away with siphoning off America's wealth? Which could also be titled, you know, how the libertarians took over Wall Street. Eli Lehrer may have some thoughts on that. He is the president of the R Street Institute. rstreet.org is the website. And Eli, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom. Pleasure to be back on the show.
Thanks for being back with us. Danielle was just telling me that you described yourself as a green libertarian. I've never heard of such a thing. This is not, I'm assuming, a James Cameron movie character.
No. I'm libertarian-ish in my politics, although more of a conservative. I wouldn't describe myself as a green libertarian. I'm libertarian-leaning. I think climate change is real. I work a lot with environmental groups. I certainly have a lot of sympathy with the environmental movement, not on every issue, but on a lot.
Okay. The fertilizer industry explosion.
Yep.
This particular fertilizer plant had not been inspected in several decades. The one minor inspection that it had been given by a state agency, they had been hit with a fine. They had not bothered to notify the agencies that they were required to notify, that they had many times the amount of ammonium nitrate on hand that Tim McVeigh used to blow up the McMurrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. I think perhaps more disturbing in the context of the libertarian worldview, which basically says, industry should be able to do whatever they want and they will suffer the consequences in the free market, in quotes. I don't believe there's any such thing, but using your language, is that this group has spent a group associated with this fertilizer company, the Agricultural Retailers Association, $2.9 million buying members of Congress, the Fertilizer Institute, which is a more direct representative of them, has spent $14.4 million trying to influence Congress. Again, stuff that libertarians say corporations should be able to do. You know, the money is speech. Let the rich buy whatever they need. Am I getting any of this wrong here?
Yeah, a number of things, actually. First off, I'm in agreement with you, I think, that there should have been more regulation, including government regulation of this. The fertilizer, we know it's an explosive. This is exactly why we should have regulation. I don't, simply because if it is a libertarian position to say that business should be able to do whatever it wants, that certainly isn't my position. My position is that we should have sensible regulations that make sense. Regulating a fertilizer plant that's full of something that can be used to build bombs seems like an excellent public safety thing. Texas, in addition...
You are not a libertarian, then.
Would I say that I'm necessarily libertarian? I usually describe myself as a conservative.
Charles Koch would drive you out of the organization back when he was running for president.
I certainly would never have voted for the Libertarian Party.
I see.
I never would have described myself at any point in my life as a libertarian with a large L. I really don't think much of the Libertarian Party at all. That certainly isn't my politics.
So what am I missing here? What, you know, if you're agreeing with me that there should be regulations on these, and obviously the corollary to that is the government should be appropriately funded to enforce those regulations. Obviously, it's not. It hasn't been. It hasn't been in large part because people who call themselves libertarians and conservatives have been aggressively underfunding these agencies and, in fact, trying to put these agencies out of business ever since the Nixon administration.
Well, first, Nixon created the EPA.
Congress created the EPA. Nixon tried to veto it. He was unsuccessful. He gets way too much credit for it. But it happened during his presidency.
A survey of national environmental groups rated Nixon as one of the best environmental presidents. In any case, I don't think much of Nixon either, but Nixon certainly was a big-time regulator. In any case, I don't know if the problem here, reading the Huffington Post investigation of it, which I think is excellent and would recommend to everybody, I don't think the problem here is that the agencies didn't have enough money. I think it's that they were incompetent. OSHA was in there doing some minor inspections.
They have enough inspectors that in the state of Texas they can inspect every fertilizer factory once every 37 years. You're telling me they've got enough people?
I'm not an expert on OSHA's budget. It's quite possible they need more. It's clear that nobody was watching the store. If more resources are needed, I wouldn't have any problem with
providing it. Doesn't this ultimately expose the largest flaw in libertarian theology? And that is that the libertarian theology suggests that when things go wrong, companies will readjust themselves, they will recalibrate themselves, they'll say, oh, we don't want that to happen again, and they'll start behaving in ways that are honorable and truthful because they want their customers back. First of all, that doesn't work in a large country where they can simply move someplace else and start all over again anonymously. But perhaps more importantly, that always means somebody has to die before something happens. A bunch of people died in this case.
For serious public safety things, like fertilizer plants, where they clearly have materials full of things that could be used to build bombs, that isn't a bad analysis.
What is not a serious public safety thing?
A soda plant, for example. I'm passing one right now on the road. A plant that manufactures soda. You probably cannot build a bomb.
I have been inside, actually. There was one in Michigan, a bottling plant that used to bottle, an independent bottling plant, used to bottle a really good soft drink outside of Lansing. I think it was in, I'm forgetting the name of the Oswego, sticks in my head, but in any case, the machinery in that plant, if you got too close and you stuck your hand in the wrong place at the wrong time, it would take your arm off.
That's a worker safety problem, which should be dealt with by a combination of private insurance, which is also, if you want to...
But once again, that's a matter of, okay, the company does fine until they kill somebody, and then, they can't get insurance. Why don't we prevent them from killing somebody in the first place?
A good insurance system should stop them from killing somebody in the first place. Texas emphatically does not have one. Texas, under Rick Perry and the supposedly conservative legislature, has an insurance system statewide that is full of highly suppressed rates, that does all sorts of things to subsidize insurance, largely for the benefit of a handful of people. In the property insurance thing, it is an enormous problem, and it probably contributed to the number of houses that were close to the plant.
Yeah.
And therefore a problem.
So, yeah, because they have no zoning down there, basically.
Zoning too, but you know the zoning can only go so far. You need both. But insurance, if they couldn't get insurance, then whether or not.
Well, if somebody's going to kill me, I don't care if I have insurance or not. If the zoning is going to keep me from getting killed, I'm all in favor of it. But. Eli, we'll have to continue this conversation another time. I appreciate you dropping by. Eli Lehrer is the president of the R Street Institute. R Street, letter R, street.org is the website. Thanks, Eli.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good talking with you.
Bye-bye.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what do we do with these kinds of organizations? Do we really have too big a government in the United States? Is Reagan right? Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. This is the giant gaping hole in libertarian theology. Libertarian theology says, you know, government is not good. Government has no responsibility other than to prevent the use of force, inappropriate force, by one against the other. And particularly prevent the use of force by government against us, as in you will pay your taxes or you will go to jail. And or you will make sure that your fertilizer factory works or you will go to jail. Or you will make sure that your smokestacks are not polluting the air and killing off the rest of us or you will go to jail. The go to jail part being the force that libertarians are all hysterical about. And I think that this fertilizer factory down in Texas blowing up demonstrates very clearly the limits of libertarian thinking. In addition to that, we have these two trade associations that have spent millions of dollars now reaching out to Congress and to state governments to say, Ronald Reagan, you know, paraphrase Jefferson, he who governs best governs least. So govern least, please let us just get away with whatever we want. It's all about the externalities. I'm telling you, it really is. It's all about the externalities at the end of the day. And it shouldn't be. But it absolutely... Here's the thing. Here's how companies in America are getting rich. They are getting rich, and by the way, they're getting rich a heck of a lot faster than the rest of us are. The average working person has not seen their pay go up since Reagan. In fact, they've seen their pay go down. They've seen their household income stay flat. Their individual pay has dropped. The top 1% have seen enormous gains, hundreds of percents of gain, while the average person has seen their wages go down. Of course, this is exactly what Reaganomics was designed to do. 33 years of a failed Reaganomics experiment, ripping this country apart. These people that call themselves conservatives, they're really corporatists. These people that call themselves Republicans, they're really corporatists. And there's a few Democrats. Max Baucus, by the way, has announced he's not going to run for re-election. Goodbye, Max. Don't let the door hit you on the way out. He's already, 28, I think, of his top, people that he's employed are now lobbyists on Wall Street involved with tax issues. I mean, it's like, talk about corrupt officials. Talk about a corrupt system. And he's a Democrat, sort of. But all that said, this demonstrates the limits of this kind of thinking. Before Reagan came along, the average voting age American, at that time, 18 to, old age. But particularly the middle and old age are, the people over 30, more or less, when Reagan became president. If they didn't remember the Great Depression, their parents remembered the Great Depression, and they had heard all the stories about the Great Depression. And they knew what deregulation does. They knew what laissez-faire economics does. They knew the consequences of these things. And it's like Toynbee said, when the last man who remembers the horrors of the Great War dies, then only the noble glory of the Great War is remembered, and the next Great War becomes inevitable. When the last man who remembers the horrors of the Great Depression dies, then only the glory of the Roaring Twenties is remembered. And hey, let's have another Roaring Twenties. And this is exactly what's happened. And I would say it was during the Reagan administration that they started dropping like flies. And you got people like James Watt, the Secretary of the Interior during the Reagan administration. Let's sell off federal lands for pennies on the dollars. Let's give them to the mining companies, and the timber companies, and the oil companies, and whoever wants them. And, who cares if they despoil them? And once when he was asked by a news reporter, aren't you ruining our national treasures? And he says, don't worry. Jesus is going to come and make all things new. Really? I mean, I don't even see this as a religious issue. James Watt, I don't think did either, frankly. I think he was, I mean, maybe he believed that, but deep down in his heart, I believe James Watt, certainly everybody else in the Reagan administration, they were like, you know, get while the getting's good. Turn the market, you know, this libertarian notion, which sounds great if you're 14 years old. I mean, libertarianism is for teenagers, right? It's like teenagers read Ayn Rand and go, oh, isn't that cool? You know, Dagny inherits a railroad from her dad. And then the union comes along and says, no, we're not going to ride your train over your experimental trestle, at least not for your normal pay. And she says, oh, to hell with you. You're in a union. No, we can't, you know, we're, in fact, we're going to go on strike. John Galt says, that's it. We're going to go on strike. We're going to go off and create our own little libertarian paradise. We're going to start our own community. And all the billionaires leave. And the world falls apart, right? The country falls apart because the billionaires all left. That's Atlas Shrugged in a nutshell. The billionaires all went off and started their own community. And who did they hire to wash their toilets and clean their floors and repair their houses and keep the water supply going? And somehow Ayn Rand never addresses that. It just magically happens because they're billionaires. Because, of course, you know, the billionaires, the little people around them just kind of take care of everything. And wherever they go, the little people go. And those people should have no rights after all. They're just the little people, as Leona Helmsley said. I mean, only the little people pay taxes.
Yeah. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Certainly the Mitt Romneys of the world, the banksters of the world, the rulers of the universe. Taxes? No. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, just a heads up, Saturday. Well, Friday and Saturday. I think it's going to be Mike replacing me on Friday. Mike Newcomb, Dr. Mike Newcomb is going to be back. And thanks, Dr. Mike, for Monday and Tuesday. I was called away. It was one of these things that was unanticipated and was urgent. And I I'll just leave it at that. It wasn't a secret meeting with President Obama. I know somebody thought it was. No. But I had to go out of town for a day. And thank you to him. On Friday, this has been planned for months and months and months. On Friday, I will be in Portland, Oregon, Friday night, 7 to 9, at the Unitarian Universalist Church. It's down 12th Street, as I recall. And it's downtown. Anybody in Portland knows where it is. And I've spoken there many, many times over the years. And this is going to be a hoot. And on Saturday, I'll be in Salem, Oregon, 1 to 3 in the afternoon at the Grand Theater. It's 7 to 9 p.m. In Portland at the UU. And, you know, I'm going to be talking about corporate personhood and my book on equal protection and all that kind of thing. And it's sort of a setup for a much larger campaign that is going to happen May 3rd through 5th, which is, what, the following weekend, I think? I don't have a calendar in front of me, but that would make sense, given how late it is in April. That is going to be when David Cobb and Caitlin and a bunch of people from Move to Amend are going to be showing up. And Move to Amend, of course, nearly 300,000 individuals, over 400 endorsing organizations, over 160 local affiliates around the United States. Great organization. And if you haven't been to movetoamend.org and you haven't signed up, do so! Do so now! But I will be in Portland, not on behalf of Move to Amend, but just, you know, as my lonely voice to back to the town where that was my hometown for half a decade. And I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So if you're in the Portland area or in the Salem, Oregon area, this weekend should be really, really interesting. And because on Friday, Dr. Mike is going to be filling in for me, Bernie's going to be on tomorrow. So we'll have brunch with Bernie tomorrow. So that's our week. Just so you know, it's going to be a great week. I wanted to share with you my thoughts about, balancing our constitutional rights for security. I'm going to get into this, I guess, at some greater length tomorrow, or not tomorrow, in the next hour, excuse me, in 30 minutes. But let me just say, you know, in summary, while I think that there are some rights, the right of free speech, that appropriately we limit, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Our Second Amendment rights, our gun rights, you can't own a shoulder-fired rocket launcher, and frankly, I don't think you should be able to own an AR-15 or a high-capacity clip, but that's just me. That's certainly not the position of the Democratic Party, and it's nothing close to anything that's been proposed legislatively. All that said, the one area where the libertarians do speak a real truth, one that our founders were very, very aware of, is that, you know, government is the one agency that actually has the power to kill us, to imprison us and to kill us. And A, we should not be outsourcing that to private corporations as we are with private prison corporations. Awful things are happening as a consequence of that. It's why we've become prison nation. And B, there need to be serious limits on that. So I'm going to get into that in the second hour. But also, one of the most important things that I think that we can do as a nation, as a people, is to say the libertarian idea that companies will always operate in their own self-interest, which will always be the best thing for the public interest because they want people to love them, is nonsense. It might work in a country that had 5,000 people in it. I mean, it's just like Karl Marx's communism, when implemented, works in a kibbutz with 300 people. Ayn Rand's libertarianism might work in a town of 300 people. But both of these utopian ideals require perfect behavior on the part of people. And when people behave imperfectly, sociopathically, when they can hide, when they can leave, when they can go someplace else and not be known, when they can behave anonymously, when they can by remote control cause things to happen, they can live in one city and they can live off in New York, and they can say to the but they own a fertilizer plant in Texas, and I have no idea who owns this fertilizer plant, but for example, you know, hypothetically. They could say, oh, yeah, ammonium nitrate, yeah, go ahead and do it. And, you know, if we get busted by the EPA, it'll be a $100,000 fine. It's the cost of doing business. We're making millions. Hey, what's the big deal? It's like the banksters. You know, look at how many hundreds of billions of dollars, arguably trillions of dollars in profits and whatnot they made, you know, with, you know, hustling bad loans and then turning those loans into CDOs and then selling those CDOs and the whole, you know, Carl Levin using the S word over and over and over again in the hearings. You remember all that, those e-deals and all this kind of stuff? These banksters knew what they were doing. And they knew that there might be some fines, but hey, the company's going to pay it. It's just a cost of doing business. We'll make more profit than that. So, Ken in Great Falls, Montana. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. You know, as a young man, I was fortunate enough to get an apprenticeship. My dad got me in the union. I became a welder, mm-hmm. building refineries and fixing them. And mm-hmm. I remember all the stuff I was exposed to, and I kind of wondered about it. But, you know, I wasn't too concerned. I didn't think anyone would do that on purpose, you know, that would hurt me. But later on, I went and got a degree in mechanical engineering and studied industrial hydrogen and realized all of the toluenes and benzenes and everything else that is in my lungs, in my...
The chemicals to which you were exposed working in a refinery.
Right, and I've had friends that I work with that have died in their 40s and 50s from brain cancer and liver cancer.
Yep.
And the thing that really shocked me once, I came out, I used to work evenings when I could because it'd be cooler in the summer, and I had yellow dots all over my car. And I went home and washed it off, and I came back, and it had burnt down to the metal. See, what that was, when fineries would like to clean up their units, they'd do something called lancing the boilers, which means they'd pour the fuel to them and burn the stuff out instead right. of cleaning it by hand.
Right.
Well, this stuff would go into the air, black smoke. They do it at night.
Right.
You couldn't see it. I used to watch it 4 o'clock as the sun was coming up, and this stuff would all be turned off, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was sad that my car, they gave me a brand-new paint job. About 5 of us got paint jobs that night. But right next to where that plant was in the middle of town were a lot of houses. You know, and you wonder about the houses with the windows open,
yeah.
the little children in the beds, the babies.
Yeah.
The stuff that could burn right through paint down to the metal.
Yeah. Yeah.
You wonder what it does to people, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, there's no heart. There's no concern there. There's a concern if they get caught.
Yeah. It's all about making money. I mean, it's just, yeah, that's the bottom line. It's all about making money. And increasingly, the concern if they got caught is not, hey, somebody's going to do a perp walk. It's not that some white fat cat is going to have to go to jail. It's that, or the occasional woman or minority that corporate America lets in. It is really that it is, might hurt the bottom line a little bit, but hey, let's make some money while we can get away with it. And we can convert it into paychecks and we can put it in our Swiss bank accounts. And if the government ever wants it back, they're not going to get it from us. That's how these guys are thinking. Ken, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Thanks for watching us there in Missouri. Steve, listening in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yeah, I just think that the concept that we need more government is a nice sentiment, but it doesn't really work in the real world, primarily because as you like to call them, banksters got all free because the regulators were busy watching porn all the time.
No, that's not true, yeah, Steve. You know. You've been listening to Fox News or watching Fox News or listening to right wing talk radio. The fact of the matter is that during the Reagan administration, in fact, Paul Krugman documented this really well just over the last couple of days in his blog. During the Reagan administration, the banksters were deregulated to a fairly substantial extent. I mean, Reagan set this thing on course. And then at the end of the Clinton administration, Phil Graham, whose wife Wendy was on the board of Enron, and Ken Lay, of course, of Enron, wanted to get big time into the banking business. He wanted to be able to bank electricity and oil, and he wanted to be able to trade in these things and these commodities, and he couldn't. And so they blew up Graham Leach Bliley, they blew up Glass-Steagall so that Phil Graham could have his bank and he could speculate with it. And other banks, of course, got in on the act. And also so that he could create commodities out of things that weren't actually commodities, that weren't actually pork bellies and wheat. In other words, oil futures, electricity futures. And that is what happened. And that is what brought down our economic system. And as it's continuing to, it's going to make it even worse. It's Reaganomics on steroids. It's deregulation. Your turn.
Well, now, how is that possible when
history.
Well, I know, but how is it possible when you've got Democrats in control of everything? There couldn't be anything going wrong.
A, you don't have Democrats in control of everything, and B, not all Democrats are that much more wonderful than all Republicans. But the fact of the matter is, this libertarian theology that Maggie Thatcher brought to the world in 78, that Jimmy Carter even started believing. I mean, he started deregulating things in 78. The transportation industry, the airlines, the trucking industry. But Reagan put it on steroids. That libertarian ideology is destroying America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And not just America. They call it neoliberalism in Europe or austerity, and it is converting the commons into, the property of the wealthy people. That's it. Ah, yes, our cheesy news report from Andy Borowitz, the BorowitzReport.com, BorowitzReport.com. Federal investigators said today they were baffled as to why millions of people chose to believe something they read yesterday on Twitter, a social media site that has falsely reported the deaths of more than 75,000 different celebrities. It's mystifying, said one investigator working on the case. One theory we're considering is that people who spend time on Twitter eventually lose their capacity for critical thinking and become sheep. The Syrian Electronic Army, the group of hackers who claimed responsibility for yesterday's hoax, said they were flabbergasted that it created such chaos. Honestly, we didn't think anyone would believe it, being on Twitter and all. At Twitter headquarters, a company spokesman said that yesterday's incident, which briefly caused the Dow to plunge 100 points and temporarily wiped off $136 billion of value from the S&P 500, was testament to the amazing growth of Twitter. Twitter spokesman said, in a few short years, Twitter has evolved from a mere website, mere waste of time into a force capable of massive havoc and destruction. We're excited to see what Twitter does next. Right. Thank you, Andy Borowitz. No, it's a tongue-in-cheek report, but it's not. I mean, it's a very interesting one. You know, David in Bitely, Michigan. David, I was just talking just a moment ago with a fellow about what happens if the drug war ends, if we decriminalize pot. You know, we've got the most prisoners of any country in the world. Half of them are there for drug crimes, a lot of them for pot. What happens if we decriminalize pot or all drugs? And suddenly we have half our jail cells empty, and these are for-profit prison industries. What's going to happen? What are your thoughts, David?
Well, actually, I was calling about the, we're talking about whether or not the gentlemen at the Boston bombings were supposed to, or they should have, been
Mirandized?
Yes. Maybe we'll clear up something in this nation if we find out. What is your opinion? What is the criteria for terrorism? What is the criteria for civil infractions?
I don't see them as any different from each other. I think that there are basically two categories that we have historically had. One is one sovereign nation takes on another sovereign nation, and the second is crimes, organized crimes, groups of criminals, individuals commit crimes against other individuals or against nations, but typically against other individuals. And this terrorism as a noun, as a category, terrorism is a tactic. It is not, you know, you can't stand up and say, I am joining the terror. Yeah, what does that mean? You know, it means that you're going to use a tactic. Well, it's like, say, you know, I'm going to join the Navy. I'm going to, you know, use ships at sea. I'm going to join the Air Force. I'm going to use airplanes. I mean, terrorism is a tactic. And for us to say that people who use that particular tactic compared to some other tactic are, you know, not criminals, they're something special and unique, is to, frankly, in my opinion, empower them. It turns them into something bigger than they are.
Well, I guess when I look at it is from my side of it, when I think of a terrorist, I think of a terrorist group. I think of a person who has affiliations with...
You mean like a KKK?
Yeah, or they could be of any affiliation. They're a group. They're a group terrorizing the nation.
So you arrest them, and you put them in jail. You know, I mean, this is what we do with gangs. This is what we do with the KKK. This is or have, you know, and if they are trying to influence business or they're trying to influence politics, then we do what we did with the mafia, with RICO, the Racketeering and Influence Corrupt Practices Act. You go after them with the force of law as criminals, but they're all criminals.
Right, but I look at an act of one individual against society, either it be the bombing or one person or two persons, and I look at that as a personal attack on society in itself.
Right.
It's not a political statement. It is merely a twisted.
Even if it was a political statement, it is a crime, and it should be treated as a crime.
Exactly, but when you talk about terrorism, you draw in a whole different facet.
When we elevate terrorists to the level that George Bush created for them, and keep in mind, by and large, before the Bush administration, we didn't have this mindset. What we do is we turn them into, it's like Lex Luthor, you know? We turn them into super anti-heroes. And I realize that Superman would be a boring movie or a boring series or comic books were it not for there being super bad guys. You can't have a superhero if there aren't super bad guys. And George W. Bush wanted us to be a superhero, so he wanted to be Superman, so he had to have Lex Luthor. So he created this super category, you know, he's got incredible powers. Osama bin Laden, his powers are so great we can't even have him in America. People affiliated with him their powers are so great. Lindsey Graham and all these other cowards in Congress, these poor, trembly white guys, you know, they're just, we're so afraid of them. We can't have them in the United States. We got to keep them in Guantanamo because they're, you know, come on, guys. They're not supermen. They're not super anti-heroes. They're either, you know, people who are deserving of a trial and innocent until proven guilty, or religious zealots, or criminals. And if they're criminals, you put them in jail.
I'm concerned, Tom, with the idea that if we bring terrorism down to the civil level, okay, that everybody that does something that vaguely even resembles a terrorist act will be classified as a terrorist.
It would work the other way around. If you bring terrorism down to the civil level and you say there is no special category of terrorism, You committed a crime or you didn't commit a crime. Then what we do is we strip these people of their superhuman status. And then they're no longer going to aspire to that. I mean, you've got kids who say, oh, I want to be a famous guy. I want to go out in a blaze of glory. I want to be, I'll be a terrorist. Come on. If they knew that we would laugh at them, that we would consider them just ordinary criminals, that we wouldn't take them seriously other than, well, you know, sorry, you're going to spend the rest of your life in jail. I think that all the juice would go out of it.
Well, I've always said that if these young people or the people that create these problems fell by the wayside without a whisper of hope by the media, there'd be fewer people out there.
You're absolutely right. The most powerful and effective thing we can do to stop terrorists is to stop treating them like they're Lex Luthor, like there's something special about them. There's nothing special about these people. You know, they're simply using a tactic, and that tactic is not a special tactic, and they deserve to be in jail just like anybody else.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Last night, the Jokhar Tsarnaev was given read his rights, shall we say. It's referred to as the Miranda rights because the Miranda versus somebody or other U.S. Supreme Court case. But the fact of the matter is that they're Fifth Amendment rights. The Fifth Amendment of the United States guarantees that you have certain protections against abuse by government with regard to the accusations of criminal behavior. And these rights have been codified, and somehow, and I believe it was during the Bush administration, I could be wrong, but I believe over the last couple of years, the last decade or so, the Justice Department, without any input from you or me or even our elected representatives, somehow we carved a hole in that. And we said, well, okay, you can arrest somebody and interrogate them. Now, keep in mind, when the Miranda case was ruled back in 66 or whatever the year was, when the Miranda case was ruled, they would arrest people and, you know, tie them to chairs and beat them with belts. Slap around, you know, yell at them, scream at them, threaten things to them, burn them with cigarettes, whatever. You know, threaten to put the kids in jail. In fact, in one of the memos by John Yoo and Jay Bybee, they said that crushing the testicles of a 7 or 10 year old boy in front of his father would be considered an appropriate way of interrogating his father. Look it up. So what the Miranda rights say, what the Fifth Amendment says, is that you may not do these things. And in fact, a person has the right to remain silent before you. You have to prove that they are guilty. They don't have to beg and prove their innocence to you, and they can cooperate or not cooperate, you being the government, you being all the rest of us, society as a whole, which makes it harder for us to prosecute people who are criminals and makes it much harder for us to prosecute people who aren't criminals but are easily influenced, threatened, intimidated, or frightened. And it should be hard. There is one institution in our society that we give the power to take us out of our homes or out of our cars, to bind us in ways that we cannot move, to lock us in rooms from which we cannot escape, and in some states and nationwide for some crimes, to execute us. And that one institution is our government. Now, I find it particularly ironic that the so-called right-wingers are just in love with the government's power to kill people. Oh, yeah, death penalty, great thing. Yeah, we need more of it. But somehow they're afraid of the government. They hate the government. Now, this to me is insane. I'm with Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and James Madison and these other guys who said, you know, if we're going to take on the power, if we, because they were all members of government back at the time, or almost all of them, and they certainly created it. If we're going to create an entity that is going to have this kind of power, it has to have some serious constraints. And those constraints should not have holes drilled in them unless we, the people, drill those holes. And even then, there should be some limits to what those holes can be. And here we have this so-called public safety exemption that says, well, you don't have to tell somebody what their rights are right away if they might. I mean, this goes back to a Supreme Court ruling where a guy was arrested. As I recall, I don't have the details in front of me. As I recall, he had shot or beat up his wife, and he had a gun, and he had a holster, and he was wearing the holster. The holster was empty, and the question was, where's the gun? Which is a very good question, because guns kill people. And the police asked him, where's the gun? And they asked him that before they had told him that he had the right to remain silent. And so when he went all the way to the Supreme Court, he said, you know, I shouldn't have said anything. I didn't, you know, I should have been informed of my right to remain silent. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, but that gun was a present threat to public safety. And if you'd left that gun out in the front yard where some 8-year-old could pick it up and shoot somebody, that's something that the police needed to know. And the public good was so compelling that it overwhelmed the Fifth Amendment right for you to be informed that you could be silent. Now, I disagree with that Supreme Court ruling, first of all. I don't think that we have a constitutional monarchy in the United States. I mean, I do acknowledge that we do have a constitutional monarchy in the United States, but I don't think the founders intended for us to have one. The Supreme Court should not have been able to make law like that, and they should not have been able to carve exemptions in the Fifth Amendment like that, but they did. Number one. But number two, the Justice Department, starting in the Bush administration, big time. I mean, during the so-called war on terror, but now even the Obama administration doing it. Saying, okay, we're going to take that Supreme Court ruling that said that it is possible for you to drill a little tiny hole in the Fifth Amendment. And instead of using a drill, we're going to use a jackhammer. And we're going to have even more of these exceptions. We appropriately have some regulations on our so-called Second Amendment rights to bear arms. The word well-regulated is in that sentence that also has the word arms in it. So it's fairly clear that there's some intent for regulation there. There is no well-regulated press. The right of the press shall not be infringed. Free speech shall not be infringed. And yet we do infringe it. There are certain kinds of speech that are illegal. I disagree with that as well. But I think that we have not really crossed a serious line there. I mean, I don't like it that I can't make jokes about bombs at the airport or something like that, but I understand it. By the way, the other day I was flying out when I was flying out to Los Angeles, the TSA woman who checked my ID was wearing a hijab, is that the word for the Muslim headdress, and I was so proud of my country in that moment that here's a Muslim woman in a Muslim dress wearing a TSA uniform, deciding which security line I'd go into. And I just thought, this is so cool. Anyhow, that said, the First and Second Amendment protect us. Second Amendment, let's set aside the Second Amendment because it's a whole separate thing. But the First Amendment, you know, protects us in some ways from government. But the Fourth and Fifth Amendment literally protect us from being ripped out of our homes and hung until we're dead. And the Justice Department wants, in their infinite wisdom, without consulting taxpayers or voters, the Justice Department wants to be able to say, oh, we're going to create exemptions for this. I think that's wrong.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, if you want to tell me that you think that Jokhar Tsarnaev, or whatever, however you say his name, he should have been given his, he should have been interrogated before he was given his rights, good luck. Try it. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're all watching in, or listening in Jamaica, New York, on WWRL, our blowtorch station in Manhattan. Hey, Raul, what's up?
It would be amusing if it weren't so tragic, but I think it must be that dissociative aspect of the cognitive dissonance of the conservative mind. That on the one hand, they don't trust government to do anything. Government can't do anything, but yet they want government to put people to death for crimes.
Right. These are the guys who will complain about the incompetence of the Department of Motor Vehicles, and yet they want the same institution, government, to be able to put them to death if it's proven by the standards of that government that they have committed a capital crime. I don't get it. It makes no sense to me.
So what I called about was, again, with the terrorism aspect of the criminalization of thought. On the one hand, the Republicans and the conservatives are against passing hate crime legislation because you see, it doesn't matter why you kill a man. The fact is, killing that person is a crime. But when it comes to terrorism, all of a sudden, if you go to certain websites,
all of a sudden intent matters.
Start watching you. What are you thinking? All of a sudden, your thought is the most important aspect of it. And for that, you can be tortured, killed, and imprisoned for life.
Yeah.
And
so
not even allowed to be tried in the regular justice system of the country.
Yeah. Here's my position on this, Raul, and that is that terrorizing people in and of itself, sort of like bullying, you know, terrorizing people is a crime. And committing a crime to terrorize people is a crime. And you can commit more than one crime at one time. And you can be prosecuted for more than one crime at a time. And in fact, we have a long, long history of this in the degrees of murder, whether murder was with malice or assault for that matter, you know, assault with, I forget the phrase for the kind of assault that involves, you know, intent and violence, intent for bodily harm. I mean, there's all these, there's an assault with malice, but no, there's some particular type of assault. But in any case, we've got these different categories of crime that actually have to do with thinking, with category. But that doesn't mean that we have to respond to them with anything other than ordinary law and ordinary procedures. Am I making sense here?
Your analysis that we need to have those superhuman, whether it was before it used to be the Soviets, the communists are coming.
Right.
Well, now it's the terrorists. So we always have to have that supervillain out there so that we maintain our military might and our...
So somebody can make a buck off it.
The security infrastructure, exactly.
Yeah, so somebody can make... Because that's what it's all about. If you've got a superhero, if you've got Lex Luthor out there, you need Superman, and somebody's going to come along and say, I'll be Superman for you if you just give me X million dollars or billion dollars or in this day and age trillion dollars. Raul, thank you very much. Thanks for listening to WWR. Richard watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Seattle. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom.
Hey.
I have a comment, or I'd like to ask your opinion. I believe, going back to the prosecution of so-called terrorists,
mm-hmm.
in Gitmo, haven't they let 95% of them go, roughly? And there's been everybody in the civilian courts have been prosecuted and are serving prison terms?
I don't know the exact numbers. I'd be reluctant to quote them. I know that a lot of the people who have been prosecuted for terrorism in our what are called Article 3, in other words, constitutional courts, Article 3 of the Constitution, normal courts, have been prosecuted. There are hundreds of Americans in normal American prisons right now serving jail terms for terrorism and terrorism-related crimes. Yes, and Gitmo would have been closed 4 years ago if Congress had funded the closing of it. They refused to allow President Obama to close it, and it continues to be a stain upon America. And I think that we should all know, and it should be reported every day, that about half of all the prisoners at Gitmo right now are being force-fed with tubes down their noses into their stomachs.
Right.
They're on a hunger strike over the brutal and inhumane conditions that they're facing and the fact that they are not entitled the rights that this country claims we're fighting on behalf of in Afghanistan and Iraq and for which we arrested them.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more. And a few callers back, my fellow Washingtonian from Squim, the terrorism might even go so far as to say the right wing and some Republicans, the way they've treated this country with their obstructionism could almost be called terrorist.
I agree.
In their own right.
I agree. And I think that if you want to have a crime called terrorism, again, I don't think that there should be any special exemptions to constitutional rights. People should be prosecuted for that crime the same as they are for shoplifting. In other words, there's you know, an absolute normal criminal procedure for it. But I think that there have been some people, and there continue to be some people who have been engaged in terrorist activities who are genuinely terrorizing people. And this is and the right gets all hysterical about this because the category is called hate crimes, right? And hate crimes, in my mind, are just terrorism. They are one and the same. And there is a way to prosecute for that. So, Richard, thank you for the call. Eric, in Emporia, Kansas, watching on Dish Network on Free Speech TV. Got a minute to the break, Eric. It's all yours. What's up?
Okay. I'm glad you're taking the time to talk about some of the legal issues here because the Boston bombings, when I heard about them searching all those homes,
mm-hmm.
I was just aghast. And I had to think, what would I do? If I looked, I had her knock on the door and I look out in the street and there's dozens, maybe hundreds of law enforcement people out there,
yeah.
And vehicles, and they want to search my house. What would I do?
Yeah.
Of course, my first impulse would be to defend my sanctuary, you know.
But if you yeah. knew that there was a guy running around who had killed four people and tried to kill a lot more than that. Might you not be inclined to say, come on in, look under my bed? I'm serious. I'm serious. It is a tough one. And I don't know to what extent those SWAT team investigations were mandatory. I'm quite sure that they were, and I think that there's a legal provision for that. But that's a good question. Eric, thank you for raising it. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
On the other hand, the requirement that people not go out of their houses in Boston, it needs to be repeated over and over and over again, people were not prevented from leaving their houses. They were merely requested. Welcome back. This is interesting. Mayors against illegal guns. You know, this is Mayor Bloomberg's thing. He's largely funded it, although he's got a bunch of other mayors involved with it and other groups and other people. They are running a TV ad campaign against Kelly Ayotte. Is it pronounced Ayotte? I think Ayotte. Ayotte, Ayotte, however you say it. This the new Republican from New Hampshire. She's a Republican, is she not? Yeah. Oh, yeah. And along with former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords group. And her approval ratings now have dropped 15%, Senator Ayotte, since she voted to prevent the federal government, to prevent gun sellers from asking people if they're terrorists, basically. To prevent, you know, people from at gun shows from selling guns to terrorists. Or to mentally insane people, violently insane people. Or to people with criminal histories that involve violence. Or with restraining orders against them. By, you know, spousal abuse and things like that. So Kelly Ayotte, you know, she sided with the terrorists. She sided with the mass murderers. They're debating about Mark Pryor because he's a Democrat. And here's the debate. You know, the Republicans were virtually unanimous in saying that they were on the sides of the terrorists. I mean, the Republicans are always on the sides of the terrorists. Look back at the Bush administration. Osama bin Laden wanted an overreaction from us. He wanted to bleed us dry. He said so. You can read his words to that effect. It's a book called The Collected Writings of Osama bin Laden. He writes at length about this, how he's, you know, George Bush is a fool. He's going to get him to overreact. He's going to spend trillions of dollars. He's going to waste American treasure. He's going to bring us down the same way he brought down the Soviet Union. He's going to destroy the American empire. And sure enough, George Bush overreacted and spent trillions of dollars, and tens of thousands of Americans left their blood or their limbs on the soil of Iraq and Afghanistan, and thousands died, and hundreds of thousands are coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder, other disabilities, depleted uranium. Their children are going to have birth defects and deformities. They are going to have lifelong health problems, and millions of Iraqis and Afghans. So Bush did exactly what bin Laden wanted. And then he said, no, I'm not going to look for him. I don't much care about him. I don't think about him that much. I mean, it took President Obama to take out bin Laden. Bush wasn't going to do it. I'm sorry. The Republicans are in with the terrorists. You can accuse me of hyperbole. Prove it. Bush had bin Laden at Tora Bora. He let him go. Afghanistan offered to arrest bin Laden and give him to Bush before 9/11. If we would just don't bomb Afghanistan, your problem's not with us. Your problem's with bin Laden. We'll arrest him and we'll hand him to a third party for trial. Bush said no. The vast majority of Americans don't know that, but it was right there in the Washington Post. I just find it rather amazing. The Republicans always side with the terrorists. Why? Because they need the terrorists. They need the terrorists because if they don't, this is screenwriting 101. If you want to have a superhero, you have to have a supervillain. The superhero can only be as good as the supervillain. If Superman ran around and stopped bank robbers and 7-Eleven people sticking up 7-Elevens and you know, gangbangers hijacking cars, Superman wouldn't be Superman. He wouldn't be. You've got to have a supervillain. Literally, I mean, this is like screenwriting 101, novel writing 101, fiction 101. The goodness of the good character is defined not by the good character. The goodness of the good character is defined by the evil of the evil character. And for the Republicans to stand around and beat their chests and go, I'm Claudius, I'm the stronger, they've got to have an evil on the other side. This goes all the way back to the time of McCarthy, Joe McCarthy. They're communists in the State Department. They're going to take us down. Look out for the communists. We got to build more nukes. They've always got to have an enemy. And they've got to make you and me afraid of that enemy. They've got to terrorize us so that we're so afraid of the supervillain that they can be the superheroes. And, you know, Lindsey Graham's still trying to do it. Well, I think that maybe we should, you know, I'm sorry, Lindsey, I'm not buying it anymore. Oh, but they're terrorists. Well, I don't care. More people die every year in the United States from slipping in their bathtubs than die from terrorism. Are we going to create a national hysteria about bathtubs? Well, no, that's a for-profit industry. You know. Are we going to mandate that they put some no-slip surface on the bottom of them? Maybe, might be a good idea. I don't know if it's been done or not. I don't think so. I mean, I know that they do it in hotels. Their insurance companies make them do it. But anyway. Mark wants to disagree with me, so let's hear what he has to say. Hey, Mark, in Bradenton, Florida.
Yeah, Bill Clinton had Osama bin Laden too.
Bill Clinton fired three missiles from a ship at bin Laden at bin Laden's camp, missed him by 30 minutes, and the Republicans rushed to the floor of the United States of the House of Representatives to say that Bill Clinton was trying to wag the dog and distract us from the real problem that we were facing, which was the fact that Bill Clinton got a BJ in the White House and it was all about Monica. Give me a break. Bill Clinton fired three cruise missiles at Bin Laden's camp, and somehow Bin Laden got a little advance warning, 20, 30 minutes advance warning. I mean, Bill Clinton missed killing Bin Laden by 30 minutes. And the Republicans took to the floor of Congress to condemn Bill Clinton for trying to kill Bin Laden. How dare he? And this was after, you know, Bin Laden had been involved in a variety of terrorist attempts. And it may have been after the USS Cole. I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure it was. So don't give me this nonsense. Brian in Dunkirk, Indiana. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you again. I had two real quick comments, if I may.
Yeah.
Number one, it is a terrible tragedy about the terror bombing in Massachusetts or in Boston. But how many people in this last week have been killed by their fellow Americans due to handgun violence?
On average, 88 a day.
88 a day, but yeah. We don't hear anything about that.
No.
And if they could mobilize such an army of officers to track these two down because they were terrorists, why couldn't they surround a gang-ridden, crime, drug-ridden neighborhood and seal it off and go in and try to track down?
Well, the problem there is that most of the people living in that neighborhood, Brian, are decent, law-abiding people. And the problem is one of massive inequality and poverty. And we have seen through the crime, I mean, if you look at the crime statistics and you look at the welfare statistics, you look at the money statistics over the last 60, 70 years in the United States, or take it back to the Great Depression. What you find is that when people are dropped into extreme poverty, terrible despair, no possibility of getting a job, no industry, all the jobs have been shipped overseas, the neighborhood is dead, there's nothing left. The only way that an entrepreneur can make money is by selling something illegal. And, you know, there's a little bit of entrepreneur in all of us. I mean, you know, everybody has, not everybody, but a lot of people have the ability to be a small business person. And if the only small business you can do is selling pot or cocaine or heroin or something like that, or for that matter, illegal weapons, then that's what's going to happen. And so, you know, what we need to do, if you want to surround a neighborhood and do something, we need to surround a neighborhood by building a factory there and saying, you know, we're going to stop giving tax breaks to companies to ship jobs overseas, and we are going to give a tax break to companies to bring their jobs back to the United States, especially if they repatriate the cash along with it. And I'm not in favor of a big tax break, but, you know, something. Let's make it happen. You know, let's give them a set. Let's make it happen. And when those factories come back, the people in these neighborhoods from my dad's generation to today have not changed. But the neighborhoods have gone from being thriving, vibrant, healthy communities, in some cases white communities, in some cases communities of color, in some cases mixed communities. They've gone from being thriving, vibrant communities where there was a factory that anchored them and everybody had a job and there were stores and there were businesses locally owned and working well, to screaming ghetto, awful, horrible place. Why? Because there's no jobs, there's no money, there's nothing. And during the time that we have tried to at least put a floor under them with things like Johnson's Great Society, he cut poverty in half in the United States in 4 years. And with it, what went down? Crime. Crime went down. And then we reformed welfare during the bubble. And then the bubble burst, and what happens? Everything goes to hell. So, but that's, you know, I think it's an apples and oranges thing. But your point, Brian, is well made. And thank you for watching Free Speech TV and Megan. Thanks for the call. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Brand new Fox News poll after the bombing says 77% of gun-owning households want background checks. Don't forget to eat them. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. You know, you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped. And the person who took the photo may well be Ellen Ratner, who created her own little charity called GoatsForTheOldGoat.com in memory of, may I say the year?
Sure.
Of your 60th birthday.
Yes, that was almost 2 years ago.
Yeah, let us not forget her. In any case, goatsfortheoldgoat.com, and because you and I went, you took me, thank you very
right.
much.
And you're welcome South to Sudan. Come back again.
And I will.
Great.
I must. And did you know that Rusty Humphries and I simulcast our shows together last week?
I heard about that. I hear that was wild.
You've got to tell Michael. We have to figure out a way to tell Michael Harrison about it.
Yeah,
or
if you write it up for me, I'll get it in our thing.
We've got photos of it and everything.
Oh, wow.
Because Rusty was on the trip with Ellen. That's why I bring it up. But anyhow, go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com is the sponsor, as it were, or underwriter.
I do take a picture of the goats with the people, and that's why I go to South Sudan, because very honestly, I mean, I hate to say it, but I don't trust anybody, so I want to take the picture of the person with the goat and make sure that they get it, other than somebody say, oh, take a picture of the goat, here's 2 Sudanese pounds, go away, you know, and I'll keep the goat.
So you're actually making sure that, that's very wise.
Been around nonprofits in foreign countries too long.
I have too, yeah. And, well, for that matter, even here in the United States,
it's scary.
You know, you've got to keep the eye on the ball. Anyhow, so what's going on in the world?
Okay, well, Joe Pitts, he's a Republican from Pennsylvania. He put forth a bill called Help Sick Americans Now Act. Eric Cantor pulled the bill. It would have taken part of the Affordable Care Act and then given it to people who supposedly didn't have money for insurance, et cetera. But it was just a sneaky way of trying to eliminate part of President Obama's Affordable Care Act.
In other words, this guy wanted to take a bite out of Obamacare.
Exactly. And so even Eric Cantor realized he didn't have the votes.
Wow.
Yeah. Senator Murkowski from Alaska and Schumer of New Jersey, they want an independent investigation as to why the TSA decided and then delayed small knives on airplanes.
Yeah, you know, I flew to Los Angeles day before yesterday, and I flew back yesterday afternoon. And I'm sitting on the plane, and I got all these freaking flyer miles, right? So I get upgraded to first class.
Right.
I'm sitting in first class, and they bring me dinner, and I'm literally in the front row. You know, I was at last minute, right? So you get stuck in the front row, which is considered not the best seat.
Right.
And 5 feet from the cockpit door, and they hand me a metal knife. And I'm sitting here with a knife in my hand, you know, to cut my
staggering
salad with. And, well, yeah, but they've been doing it for years.
Right.
It's like, you know, this seems like a tempest in a teapot.
I don't really like the idea of people bringing knives on planes. It just gives me the creeps.
Yeah, it gives me the creeps, too. But
because they can be very sharp knives.
Yeah, they can be. But there are, you know, I can show you catalogs of glass knives that are undetectable by x-rays that, you know, I mean, anyway.
Anxiety. This is from somebody that was in Watertown, Massachusetts on Thursday
night. See, I have very
little
anxiety about this because, look at all the people, including a crazy flight attendant. You know, she had gone off her meds. I think, frankly, she'd probably taken one of the anti-malarial meds, who have been literally taken down by passengers.
Right.
I mean, I don't think since 9/11 another 9/11 is going to happen, and I'm not that way.
Okay.
At least not that way. I'm not worried.
Senator Lautenberg, speaking of exactly what we're talking about, wants to require background checks for the sale of explosives. He first put this legislation together in 2003. Obviously, it didn't get anywhere. He also wants the ATF to do a study to see if it's possible to track explosive powder, the black powder.
It is possible. The chemicals are called TAG. And they're sophisticated enough that you can identify individual lots of explosives.
Well, you know that this bill will go absolutely nowhere in the House.
Right, right.
But he's trying to do it.
Because the NRA is also the lobbyist for bomb makers.
Well, you're just on my next thing. The Violence Policy, with great minds think alike today. Violence Policy Center accused the National Rifle Association today of protecting the gun industry by lobbying against regulations of explosives, the kind of explosives used in Boston, not only the gun, but obviously the explosive industry,
right.
People who make gunpowder, et cetera.
Right.
So they're now accusing the NRA of doing that.
The company that sold these guys, the Sarnyov or whatever brothers, the fireworks that they used to get the explosives from.
The New Hampshire company.
Yeah, that company has come out and said, oh, yeah, we sold it to them. Well, if there had been a tagant in that gunpowder, They would have known within an hour where it came from, and there was an actual record of this guy, not Zokar, but his brother, whatever his name was, actually buying it from that company. I mean,
right.
They would have known within hours who this guy was, and he'd already been interviewed by the FBI, and all of this nonsense would have been unnecessary. They could have picked it. He was back at his house. They could have picked it. Don't get me started.
Sequester. One report said that the FBI could not issue an award to try and capture the Marathon bomber because the sequester won't allow them to give out awards. Well, that's crazy because, of course, the sequester will allow them to give out awards. But, of course, they have to also cut down personnel, so you want
to... Right, so they have to lay off three agents and give their salaries to some guy.
Fleet Week went away in New York City because of the sequester. Right. But Americans for Prosperity. That's the Karl Rove group, right? They're tomorrow going to hold a Reagan Airport protest saying that the White House has prompted these delays in air transportation.
Right. And in fact, Boehner and even has this Obama sequestered flight delay hashtag thing. But the fact of the matter is that the cuts to the FAA were actually written into the sequester legislation by the Republicans and promoted by John Boehner.
And if you look at something like, according to the White House, and I have no reason to doubt them, 77% of the FAA's expenses are salaries. So you got to cut it somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, and what they're cutting are controllers. And now it's like, holy cow, we did what? But they're trying to blame it all on the president.
Your friend, Daryl Issa is going to hold another hearing on Benghazi to examine new facts, he says.
Of course. Daryl Issa is like, he is convinced Benghazi is Monica Lewinsky. Right? He's convinced this is going to be the thing that this is, he's going to impeach the president over this, and he's going to, give it up, Daryl. Come on. I mean, you know, go back to being a small-time crook. Come on. Anyway, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you for putting up with my offensive editorial comments.
I love them.
And goatsfortheoldgoat.com, the underwriter for this segment. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Hey, by the way, I want to thank Daily Kos Radio and Netroots Radio. Both of these progressive outlets are now carrying this program in CD quality audio. Please check them out online, dailykos.com and netrootsradio.blogspot.com. And thanks, guys, for carrying the show. We really appreciate it. And honor the great work that you're both doing and have been doing for so many years. Speaking of doing great work, Les Leopold is one of the smartest guys I know. He's the executive director of the Labor Institute of New York. He's a journalist and author. And his latest book, this is an amazing title, but it's perfect. It's just perfect. How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth. Les Leopold, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. How do you make $1 million an hour?
You have to cheat.
Uh-huh.
Basically, that's what it comes down to. Maybe some don't, but I think a majority do.
But it's a form of cheating that the risk of prosecution is pretty much zero, isn't it?
It's very hard to catch them. Some of what they do actually is legal. Some is borderline, and a lot of it is way over the line.
Okay, and the stuff that is legal is presumably legal because they helped make sure that the laws were written in a way that legalized it?
I think that's well put. High frequency trading, for example, where they jump in ahead of your trade and buy something that you want to buy and bump up the price a couple of seconds because they do it in a couple of dollars, so they do it in nanoseconds, right. And you don't even notice it. That's legal.
So in other words, wait a second. If I own stock and I have it with one of these electronic or any brokerage firm. And I say, you know, I'd like to buy 100 shares of Apple or 1,000 shares of Apple or 1,000,000 shares of Apple, depending on, you know, who I am. I mean, with me, it would be 10 shares of Apple. I don't even think it would be 10. Apple's pretty damn expensive. But in any case, I want to buy 100 shares of Apple. I place that order with them, and you're telling me that before they execute that order, they buy some Apple stock The price goes up so that they sell it to me at a higher price, and then they or they sell it. How does it work?
Here's what they do. They set up their computers right next to the stock exchange, so they get the price in nanoseconds before all the other brokerages in the world.
Right, and it's not just me buying Apple stock. It's 100,000 people all at once.
Who's ever out there.
Yeah.
They can, when they see an order coming, they jump it and buy it and then resell it back to you for a few pennies more per share. And they do this again and again, like a million times an hour. Half of the stock market, at least, some say up to 80%, are high-frequency traders. And they make from $5 to $20 billion a year doing this.
Just skimming off our trades.
Skimming it off. It's like a hidden tax. And there's no redeeming virtue to this whatsoever. They say it, you know, brings liquidity to markets. That's garbage. What they're doing is milking all the rest of the investors without producing any value. One guy said he hadn't had a losing day in 5 years, right through the crash. Not a losing day in 5 years.
Nice work if you can get it.
Yeah, really. And he said the longest he held a stock, the longest, was 2 seconds.
Wow. And now the National Nurses United and a number of other groups are out there calling for what they call the Robin Hood tax. We had a tax, correct me if I'm wrong on my dates here, but I think it started during the Spanish-American War, like in, you know, 1898 and ended in 1964 or 66. It was kicked up in 1935 by Franklin Roosevelt in order to help pay for the Securities and Exchange Commission and Joe Kennedy's salary. But we basically had this like 0.1% tax on every stock traded, and that generated a fair amount of money. And in fact, when we did away with it in the 60s, the rationale for doing away with it was generating hundreds of millions of dollars, and it didn't cost that much to run the SEC. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do.
Okay.
And what would happen
if we brought this tax back? These guys are saying you bring this tax back, you basically put these high-frequency traders out of business.
Oh, you put the high-frequency traders out of business, and you generate enough revenue, I estimate, so that every kid in this country could go to a public college, two-year, four-year graduate school, free, tuition-free. We can eliminate the debt problem for young people going to college.
No more student debt. And all we have to do is stop what is being done by what, maybe 30, 40 people on Wall Street, or is this a very much larger industry?
It's probably larger than that. You know, let's say it's 10,000 people or whatever, but still it's a very small number who run these games.
Right. Amazing. Amazing. So 10,000 guys are making anywhere from hundreds of thousands to billions. I read last year that there were over a dozen people on Wall Street who made more than $2 billion last year doing this kind of thing.
The top guy on the top hedge fund guy last year made as much in 1 hour as the average American family made in 21 years. Think about that.
Doing something that doesn't produce one damn thing for this country.
No value at all. And a matter of fact, some of the games, one game I can't help but not want to mention to this audience, produced negative value. Here was one that was very popular during the crash, which is they packaged the worst mortgages they could find, the ones that had the teaser rates that were about to fail, where people are going to go in default. They packaged them so they could bet against them.
This is what Carl Levin, you know, the blanky deal, you know,
exactly,
the S word.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And billions of dollars changed hands doing this. This is like you and I going out and selling a drug that would kill somebody so we can collect on their life insurance. I swear it's exactly the same thing.
Well, Walmart buys life insurance on their elderly employees and then collects.
Well, that's also something that should be illegal.
Work them to death and kill. I shouldn't say that. I don't know all the details of that. I may have something.
A billion. There was one deal with Goldman Sachs, but all the banks did it. J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs got caught because this is a rigged bet, and they didn't tell the investors. The investors lost $1 billion. The hedge fund guy made $1 billion, and Goldman Sachs got fined $550 million. Guess how much the hedge fund was fined?
How much?
Zero.
So I rob a bank and I get $1 million in the bank and I give the police $500,000 and they say, Okay, you're everything's copacetic. Actually, myself, you and I, Les,
right,
together,
we
rob a bank, and each one of us walks off with $1 million. I go to the police, or the police come to me, they catch me, and I give them $500,000, and they say, okay, everything's copacetic, and by the way, we're going to forget about your friend Les, he can keep his million.
That's basically the theme of the book. I think you've got it right there.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. We're talking with Les Leopold, the executive director of the Labor Institute of New York, journalist and author, his latest book, How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth. How much damage have these people done to this country? And when did this really, really start?
That's a good question. I think that they worked out the kinks on some of these rigged bets in the late 1990s, but it really kicked into action around 2003 and 2004, and it hit a crescendo 2005 and 2006 because they wanted to, they knew they had all these junk mortgages. They wanted to unload them. And
right.
They unloaded these toxic assets all over the globe. There's a reason why these banks in Europe are stuck with all this junk.
Right.
Our folks unloaded it.
So
it
this was like the bubble during the Roaring Twenties. I mean, that was just there was about a 5-year bubble there during the Roaring Twenties. It was based on a real estate bubble.
Well, you know, it's amazing what we didn't learn. That we did learn and then we forgot. After 1929, we, of course, put our foot on the neck of Wall Street, and the wages of Wall Street when it came down so that if you worked on Wall Street and you worked in the rest of the economy, you'd get about the same thing depending on your level of experience and education.
Right.
There was no...
From then until the 80s.
All the way till the 1980s. Then the two lines split apart. Unbelievable. Wall Street goes up because we took our foot off their neck. Once you stop regulating them heavily, they are predisposed to come up with these games. It's
amazing. Toynbee was right. When the last guy who remembers the horrors of the last great war dies, the next great war becomes inevitable. Same thing with great scams. Les Leopold, the book, How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Les, is there a website for this or just any bookstore?
I think any bookstore.
Okay, great. Any Les Leopold, keep up the great work, my friend. Thank you
so much. Thank you. You too, please.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. 21 minutes past the hour, defending America from the weapons of mass deception while we help you win the water cooler wars. And Gary, who's also hanging out in our chat room over at TomHartman.com in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, David, Gary, what's up?
You know where that is, Tom, outside Pittsburgh?
I knew it's in the vicinity of Pittsburgh, but I've never been there. So, no, I don't know where it is. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, one of these days, I'm going to shake your hand, young man.
I look forward to it, Gary. I think you've been listening to the show since we used to be on. We used to be on the air on WPTT or something like that, a station in Pittsburgh.
Yes, you were.
Yeah, years ago.
Yeah, that's about when I started listening to it, exactly. A couple things, if I may. I called because I want to commend you once more. You're on top of your game today.
Thank you.
And I'll tell you why, because you nailed it. And the second part of my...
What did I nail?
You nailed the repukes. I call them the repukes, okay? I don't call them the repugs, the Republicans. They're the repukes now. They're in a different sphere on this planet. They're the repukes. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Oh,
that's all they got.
Oh, the whole idea that you can't have Superman without Lex Luthor, and so they've got to run around screaming, oh, my God, the immigrants, the brown people, they're Lex Luthor. Oh, my God, the communists, they're Lex Luthor.
You know,
the Muslims, they're not Lex Luthor.
Great service today.
Thank you. The second thing,
and I don't want to be, this is just in my gut. We have to change this culture. We got to stop blaming the politicians, look at ourselves, and change this culture from greed, ego, and trying to be famous. That's America 2013, in my humble opinion. We've got to change that. We're not going to change it, as you well say it very well. We can't blame the politicians. We got to take action. We got to change the culture for the good of America and save our democracy.
Well, Gary, I agree that greed has no heart, as you often say. Greed is one of the darkest of the emotions. The desire of people. I'm sorry.
I interrupted you. Please forgive me. I just want to say, and I'll go and I'll, you can comment. I just think wealth, at least too much of it, undermines everything, Tom.
It's so did Jefferson.
Our democracy.
Yeah, Jefferson thought the same thing. He said that when wealth in the hands of an individual is accumulated to the point where it threatens the well-being of the state, it should be taxed in geometric proportion. And in other words, you know, start radically taxing it. And I agree with that. Gary, thank you very much, and thanks for hanging out in our chat room. Thanks for calling, and for listening all these years. Kay in Mechanicsburg, speaking from Pennsylvania to Pennsylvania. Hey, Kay, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to say, like, you know, I'm fourth generation military. I was born on a military base.
Mm-hmm.
Had married my husband, 3 out of 6 kids in the military. Now we got 3 grandkids, okay? And so, like, for a long time, Tom, I didn't even just question about the fact that we have these bases everywhere, you know? And but growing up, when I thought about the military, I had immense pride.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I'm hoarse, but I had this immense pride for who our military was and who our country was. And yes, as I get older and I do more learning, I realize there were some things my country's done that I don't really like. But on the whole, you know, it was very clear cut. Just because they torture does not mean we do. That is not how we behave. And it was just part of our character. And I cannot begin to tell you how deeply it hurt me to go through the George Bush administration and watch what Bush and Cheney did in warping the character of who we are. I mean, if I talk about it too deeply, Tom, I'm telling you, it can bring me to tears because I feel like it has damaged our military.
I agree.
And, you know, do you know why Thomas Young, he did Body of War with Phil Donahue, it was a documentary that won. It followed his being paralyzed from the neck down.
Yep.
Okay, well, you know, he just sent a letter to Bush and Cheney, an open letter. I mean, I just found it. I think
he he died.
Did he die? See, I was doing research.
I'm assuming he did. He said he was very near the end of his life.
I know. He wanted to last until April 20th, his anniversary.
Oh, okay.
You know, What upsets me is, like, all these people, and I'm not going to say just Republicans, that war is the answer for everything. I could just scream out of my skin because, you know, what is your statistics? One active duty member of the military is committing suicide every single day.
Yeah.
Do we hear about this?
No.
Do they care?
No, we don't. And the other thing that people don't notice is that the people who are who have genuinely seen the horrors of war, the Dwight Eisenhowers, Eisenhower's campaign. Pull this up, Sean, Shano. You know, when Dwight Eisenhower ran for president in 1952, and keep in mind, this was a country that was pretty damn proud of the military. We had just kicked Tojo and Hitler, right in the keister, right? And so, you know, if any time in the history of America, you know, go military. Here was Dwight Eisenhower's campaign ad. Listen to this.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
Vote for peace. He ran on the platform of peace. He has seen war. Bush and Cheney, you know, Bush spent the last year that he was in the Champaign National Guard unit AWOL in Alabama drunk, and Cheney got 5 deferments. The one guy in their administration who had actually seen war, Colin Powell, was the guy, particularly if you listen to Larry Wilkerson, his number two guy now, was the one guy who was horrified by the whole thing and very, very concerned about it.
Right. And you know, like, I'm also a social worker, so, you know, I'm a totally bleeding heart liberal. But the amount of money that we spend on what I call the Department of Offense is offensive.
It is amazing, Kay. We have lost $2 trillion that the Pentagon can't account for. Kay, thank you for the call. We ship an amount of cash, $6 billion to Iraq, on pallets big enough to see from outer space, literally, and it has vanished.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Meanwhile, Republicans want to cut school lunch programs, make sure that if you go to college, you end up $100,000 in debt, and cut veterans benefits and Social Security. good, the bad, and the very, very nudist, sternianly ugly, the good, Boyan Slat. Slat, the 19-year-old founder of the Ocean Cleanup Foundation, has devised yet another ingenious plan to combat ocean pollution. Slat's invention, the Ocean Cleanup Array, is entirely naturally powered and uses a complex combination of booms and currents to separate plastic particles from seawater. The array then stores the separated plastic and prepares it for recycling. According to Slat's website, his device could clean up the world's oceans in as quick as 5 years if he receives enough funding. Good luck, Boyan. If you're interested in helping out, check out Boyan Slat, BoyanSlat.com. The bad, Stella Tremblay. Tremblay, a New Hampshire state representative, posted a message on Glenn Book's Facebook page last Friday that congratulated the talk radio host for identifying the Boston Marathon conspiracy and linked to a video from Infowars.com. Here's what the post said. This is a New Hampshire state legislator. Quote, just as you said would happen, top down, bottom up, the Boston Marathon was a black ops terrorist attack. One suspect killed, the other one will be too before he even has a chance to speak. Drones and new terrorist attacks by our own government. Sad day, but a wake-up call for all of us. First there was a suspect, then there wasn't. InfoWars broke the story, and we knew they had been found out. End quote. Sounds compelling, Stella. What does this say about the state of our democracy when our elected representatives are citing Alex Jones as a reputable source? Somewhere George Washington, or perhaps more appropriately, Ben Franklin, you know, the newspaper publisher, is rolling in his grave. And the very, very ugly Eric Bolling. On Tuesday's episode of Fox News The Five, host Eric Bolling accused Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison of acting as an apologist for Islamic extremist terrorism and called for increased profiling of Muslim men. Take a listen.
He's also very dangerous. He's kind of been like the Muslim apologist in Congress for a long time. He swore, he raised his right hand and took the oath of office on the Koran, if you remember, in 2007, Keith Ellison did. I think it's time for profiling, though, don't you, Angie?
Disagreeing with a congressman about his policies is an essential part of democracy. But implying that he supports terrorism because of his religion, that's just very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. My. Raul in Berrien Springs, Michigan. You want to disagree with me about Dwight Eisenhower? Really?
Absolutely right, Tom. Ashes of Defeat, the new book about how he got into Vietnam.
Right.
It chronicles how Eisenhower, of course, he supplied the French and kept the war going against the Vietnamese, aiding the French with whatever
actually,
they needed.
It was also against the Chinese, actually. They were using the Vietnamese as proxy.
But he was willing to give the French tactical nuclear weapons, small atomic bombs to use on Dien Bien Phu. Thank God the French knew they were going to be defeated, and they would have killed their own men if they would have used the atomic bombs.
What year was that, Raul?
Provide. I'd have to say it was like 1954.
That early. That early. Huh.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that history, so I'll just take your word for it. I do know that in 58, 59, Eisenhower suffered a pretty massive heart attack, and Richard Nixon kind of basically ran the last year and a half, the Eisenhower administration, and a lot of strange things happened during that year, particularly having to do with J. Edgar Hoover. You know, Eisenhower was no angel, and I certainly don't mean to assert that he was an angel. Our policies in South and Central America were abysmal. Our policies with regard to, Dole Pineapple in Hawaii. I forget what year it was that Hawaii was annexed as a state, but prior to that, we'd been doing some pretty nasty stuff.
Ashes of Defeat.
Yeah, Ashes of Defeat. I'll have to check it out. But the net of it, Raul, was the point that I was making, I think still stands, which is that a man who has seen the horrors of war, as Eisenhower had done, would run for political office on the campaign of ending the Korean War and, vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower, that the American people at that point were saying, okay, we're going to vote for the guy who says vote for peace, vote for me. And today, if you say vote for peace, vote for me, you're labeled a George McGovern, who, by the way, was a World War II hero who had flown over 38 bombing missions and saved his crew by making an emergency landing in an airstrip in Italy that they said nobody could land a bomber on. Okay, point made. Raul, thank you very much. Ashes, I'll take a look for that. Legacy of Ashes. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Shano. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Now, I think we have to take a real good look at these. They're trying to link this to overseas terrorism, which it isn't. It's a couple of homegrown kids who had a radical idea.
Well, the young kid, increasingly to me, looks like he was just, you know, following his brother. The older brother, there are some allegations that he might have even committed murder prior to becoming, quote, radicalized. You know, a mentally ill, mentally unstable young man who was a big follower of Alex Jones, apparently, and also apparently was in part radicalized by our invasion of Iraq. And
yes,
you just have
I
to ask yourself,
trying to do,
you know, how many mentally unstable people are there out there, and why are we pursuing policies like now our drone wars, then our Iraq and Afghanistan invasions that simply provide, you know, mental food for these kinds of unstable people?
I think they're trying to link it because they want to restore Pentagon budget cuts. I don't think anybody realized how bad they hurt their contributors, Halliburton and the rest of them.
Mm-hmm. So you think that they're trying to link the Boston guy to international terrorism so that they can get money for the Pentagon?
Scare the American people once again.
Corky, I wouldn't make that assertion myself, but increasingly these days, nothing surprises me. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching on DirecTV. Harold, watching Free Speech TV in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Harold, you wanted to ask about the FAA?
Yeah, well, I just have a question here, because I graduated high school in 1981, and I believe, if I'm correct, that was Reagan's first year in office.
That's
was
correct.
It not?
Yeah, he was sworn in January of 81.
Right. Well, the first unions that he went after was the air traffic control unions, was it not?
It was, and they had ironically supported him for election because Bill Casey, the head of his campaign, had cut a deal with them in summer of 1980 that if they would support him, if PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, would support Reagan for president, then Reagan would support their actions to force basically the FAA to upgrade their radar equipment.
Right. Well, my question.
And Reagan
lied. I'm watching on the news where they're having all these flight delays.
Yeah.
And obviously, they're blaming it on the sequestration.
Right.
So how did the air traffic controllers become part of our government when they were their own union before?
Well, they were government employees who are unionized. About 80%, I think, of government employees are unionized even today. Our total unionization in the United States is around 13%. Around 8 or 9% of that's the private sector. The other 4 or 5% of that is public sector. In other words, government employees. The government employees unions are among the largest unions. In fact, the largest unionized employer in the United States is the post office, which is why in 2006 the Bush administration and Republicans in Congress took aim at the post office, which at that time was very profitable. They were talking about converting their cars to solar, you know, to electric power fleets and being the world's, you know, leader in jump-starting electric technology in the United States. They took aim at them by saying that they had to set aside $5 billion a year to fund the retirement health benefits of people 75 years from now who have not yet even been born, because it's the largest unionized employer in the United States. It's the second largest employer. The largest employer is Walmart, which is not unionized. So the FAA guys are unionized. The way it works with regard to the sequester is the sequester says that the FAA has to take a certain budget cut, period. And a certain amount of the FAA's budget, a very large amount of the FAA's budget, is salary, and the rest of it is, you know, actually keeping those radar screens working. They're not going to shut down the radar screens. So what they're doing is they're furloughing people. And I think I read in the paper yesterday that it's every 3 weeks each controller has to take one day off. Maybe it's every 2 weeks. And that's take a day off without pay. And so what that's doing is it's reducing the number of controllers in the towers. Somewhat. And as you reduce the number of controllers in the towers, you actually physically reduce the ability of these guys to manage as many airplanes as they were. I mean, this is just kind of physics, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republicans are trying to blame this on
their hero president, Ronald Reagan, was the one that tried to to change all that, and now they want to go to the airport here. I think you were just saying Paul, and they want to protest because of the sequestration. When, in fact, are they not the ones that created it?
Yes, the Republicans wrote into the sequestration bill, and John Boehner, do you have that clip, Shano? John Boehner claimed he got 98% of everything he wanted. He was a very happy guy when the sequestration was passed. The Republicans wrote into that bill. It was the Republicans who wrote into that bill that the FAA would take the cuts. Here's John Boehner bragging about it.
And when you look at this final agreement that we came to with the White House, you know, I got 98% of what I wanted. I'm pretty happy.
And now the Republicans are trying to claim that the sequestration is Obama's fault and that he could choose to cut the money someplace else. Well, he can't. The Republicans wrote it into the bill that the FAA has to take a cut too. Harold, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, the Republicans have even come up with this phony hashtag, you know, Obama, flight delay, something or other, something like that. But, you know, it's not, I'm sorry, Obama has no control over this. Congress controls the purse strings. It's right in the Constitution.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
All taxing and spending decisions do not originate in the White House. They originate in the House of Representatives. You got a problem with sequestration, talk to John Boehner and Eric Kennedy. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. And you remember for years and years on this program before we moved out to Washington, D.C., and actually he even followed us out here to D.C., but he had a family emergency that required that he go back to Portland. Jacob Dean was our associate producer and ran the board and came up with all kinds of cool, you know, audio things, and you all got to know Jacob fairly well. He is now back in Portland and doing a radio program of his own on the web and doing some cool stuff. And he's competing for a Democracy for America scholarship so that he can attend Netroots Nation in 2013. And so just, you know, from me to you, please support Jacob for your vote, with your vote, at nn13.democracyforamerica.com. Democracy for America, of course, Jim Dean's organization, nn13.democracyforamerica.com. And you know, I mean, vote for whoever you'd like, but my personal preference is Jacob Dean. He's a good guy. Brandon in Mentor, Ohio. It says, you disagree with me that the bomber's religion does make a difference. What does that mean?
That is correct. I think they're downplaying the fact of the influence of radical Islam in this country. And I think it's hard to believe that these kids were not radicalized.
You know, the vast majority of people who have been prosecuted for terrorism, investigated for terrorism, and arrested for terrorism in the United States have been happened because Muslims in this country have turned them in. Did you know that fact, Brandon?
Well, that's a wonderful thing, but that doesn't.
B. Look, was anybody talking about the fact that when Eric Rudolph blew up a lesbian bar and then blew up and killed a woman at the Atlantic Olympics that, you know, he was one of these Christian anti-abortion activists?
Okay, so that's an individual. There aren't Christian anti-abortion activists.
These guys are individuals too.
They go around and blow people up.
Yeah, you know, there's actually a pretty aggressive and well organized network of them. Neil Horsley, we had on this program. Alan Colmes had him on his program. In fact, on Alan Colmes' program, he was talking about how he liked to have sex with mules, of all things. Seriously, Shano, if you look for Neil Horsley, you'll probably find the clip. It's hysterical. We actually put it to some music, and he maintained a website where he had all these pictures of these. Did you find it? He had all these pictures of these abortion doctors, and when they got killed, he would put an X through their faces and directions to them and everything else. Does it start off with the Mr. Ed music?
You are known for your anti-abortion and anti-homosexual views.
This is from the Alan Paul Show.
You had sex with animals?
When you grew up on a farm in Georgia, your first girlfriend is a mule.
This is the lead anti-abortion
guy. I'm not so sure that
you didn't grow up on a farm in Georgia. did you?
Are you suggesting that everybody who grows up on a farm in Georgia has a mule as a girlfriend?
I'm saying that it has historically been the case. You people are so far removed from the
reality.
Look,
I'll admit, Neil, I'm a city boy. I don't know a lot about growing up on a farm.
Well, hello. Welcome to domestic life on the farm.
But I think for you to say,
welcome to domestic life.
There are a lot of people listening to me right, Neil, there are a lot of people listening to me right now who live on farms, are raising kids on farms, who grew up on farms, and I don't think they're dating Elsie right now. You know what I'm saying?
The fact of the matter is, don't know that in fact you experiment with anything that moves when you're growing up sexually, you're naive, and you know better than that. You know yourself. If it's warm and if it's damp and it vibrates, you might in fact have sex with it.
No, not me.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah,
no, thanks.
Come on, you know. I've had sex with anything that would move.
Right.
If we had a warm watermelon out in the field, I might give it a name.
Hello. I'm Mr. Red.
Yeah. Okay. So with a tip of the hat to Alan Colmes for doing brilliant radio. That was Neil Horsley, part of this. And let us not characterize people who are opposed to abortion by people like Neil Horsley and like, you know, people like Eric Rudolph. There are some very, very good people out there who are opposed to abortion and who even think that it should be illegal. And I think that we need to have a national dialogue about abortion in the United States. I personally, as a man, I don't. Frankly, I think that women should be the ones making these decisions. But and who is it? Somebody said the other day, you know, if men got pregnant, abortion would be as common as Starbucks. You know, it would be a sacrament. It's a who knows? But anyhow, the religion, I suppose, matters. What matters to me is the radicalization of people. People who kill other people in the name of Jesus, or people who kill other people in the name of Muhammad, are, in my mind, equally scrambled in their brains. And we need to not simplistically think that only people who do it in the name of Islam are, you know, that somehow they're unique. You know, they're not. Naba, if I'm saying that right, in Chicago, Illinois, listening to WCPT.
Hi, Tom.
Naba?
My name is Naba, yes. And I am a refugee from Iraq. Mm-hmm. I have been in this country only 4 years. And as you know, you brought a very nice subject about Bush administration and the Republican.
Yeah.
You know, they make the terrorists. They invented my country, and they hurt people. People dies in the war there, and then they say, "Oh, Muslims are killer. Muslims are the people who they are, you know, killing everybody." Okay, but you made them like this. I do not agree with killing. Of course, I do not agree with killing the innocent people in this country because they don't have anything to do with the war. But now I just want to give you an example. Like if somebody came to your house, you know, to fight with you or to steal something from you, you have to fight him.
Yeah.
But then they say that Iraqis are Muslims and they are, you know, they are terrorists and they are killer, and that's not true.
It is absolutely not true. The vast majority of Iraqis and the vast majority of human beings are decent people. Naba, thank you so much for calling, and thanks for listening to WCPT. I'm very sorry we're out of time. It's the end of the show. Coming up tomorrow, special edition of Brunch with Bernie on Thursday. America's Senator Bernie Sanders will be here. Plus, Wall Street is running wild again. We're going to talk with Mike Papantonio about that. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there and occupy something like pdamerica.org or movetoamend.org or free-don.com.
For audio and video archives, go to tomhartmann.com.
Tag, you're it.